the authors of the book. That's the main reference I'm using. I just wanted to note that today I've added a couple more chapters of relevant material. And one thing that I should have mentioned yesterday that I didn't is I just want to thank Roger Malko, because some of the notes that I'm using here are based on some lectures that he's given in the past. Okay, anyway, so yesterday we started with the goal of trying to somehow use numerical methods to study phase transitions and figure out where they are to understand various properties of them. So in particular, so far, we've just been focused on the Ising model, and that's, again, what we're going to focus on mostly today. If we have time at the end, we might briefly talk about something else, but I'm not sure that we'll get to it. So I've just written again our Ising Hamiltonian. And just to remind you, what we were trying to do is develop methods to estimate these expectation values, which involve a sum over an exponential number of states on a finite system. So what we did is we developed Markov chain Monte Carlo methods. What this did is it gave us some chain of states where M, capital M here, is much less than my number of accessible states. And we saw this single spin flip algorithm that allowed us to sample these states from our Boltzmann probability distribution. So once we have this, what we did is we estimated this expectation value from this estimator. Okay. And then, so we saw that there can be many different ways of doing this. We can have many different ways of generating these samples, as long as they satisfy these conditions of ergodicity and detailed balance. Specifically, what we looked at was single spin flip algorithms, which are basically the simplest algorithms you'll usually see for this. So, and we saw that the best one was this Metropolis algorithm. So in this case, we get a state from the previous state by only flipping one spin. So we saw that in this algorithm, we could satisfy detailed balance if we just chose a single spin on our site. We just choose that with that site with equal probability. We suggest making the move where we just flip that spin, and we're going to accept that move with this probability here. And somebody asked at the end yesterday if this was optimal, and I couldn't think of it at the time, but it's actually really simple to show that this is optimal. The reason is that from detailed balance, we know that we have to have, we wrote this yesterday. we have to have this constraint by detailed balance if we're using this single spin flip algorithm. And so this has to be true for any possible choices of mu and nu. So in particular, and the largest possible value we can ever take for one of these acceptance probabilities is one. So using this basically assures that for any mu and nu, at least one of them is equal to one, and the other one will be as large as possible. So for any possible choice of two states, one of those probabilities is going to be equal to one. And we basically can't do any better than that, because we can never have one of them bigger than one. And then the other one is just going to be fixed by this condition. OK, does anybody have any questions about what we saw yesterday before we look at some new things? OK, so I'm going to just show you a little outline of what we're going to talk about today. So first, a couple people at the end of lecture asked a few questions that showed us that we need to talk a bit about data analysis, like how we're actually going to numerically use these samples that we get. There's a few subtleties that I kind of glossed over. So specifically, we're going to talk about things called equilibration. And one that somebody definitely brought up yesterday was measurement correlations. So the fact that some of our samples might be really similar, especially if we're rejecting moves a lot of the time. Then we're going to look at some code. So this is the code that we're also going to use in tutorial today. I'm just going to show it to you guys a little bit, how it works. It's Monte Carlo code for the two-dimensional Ising model. Then, pretty briefly, I don't want to go into too much detail on this because we're not going to program it ourselves, but we're going to talk a bit about cluster algorithms. So we'll see that these single spin flip algorithms that we've been using, they don't always work very well, or they can sometimes take a long time, depending what temperatures we're trying to study, and especially on large systems. So then we're going to look at some other algorithms that we can use instead. Then we're going to talk about how we can try to figure out where the critical point is in these systems from the specific heat and the susceptibility. Some of these are pretty short points. I know it seems like a lot. Then we're going to talk about some other techniques for studying phase transitions and how we might be able to extract things like critical exponents. This is using a method called finite size scaling. So this is basically using the fact that when we do these numerical simulations, we're always on a finite system. We can't exactly and directly probe this thermodynamic limit. So we have to find proper ways to take that into account. And I'm not sure that we'll have time for it. But if we do, we can talk about simulations of a different model, which is the XY model. So finally leave the Ising model behind if we have time. We'll see. This part is not in the notes I posted, but I can upload it if we get time for it. Okay. So the idea of equilibration You remember yesterday that the algorithm we wrote down, we can start this algorithm from any random state. So mu 1 can really be anything. But we want to be generating samples from this Boltzmann distribution. But we really don't know if this mu 1 is something that's very likely to be generated from this Boltzmann distribution. So in many cases, this state that we start in and the nearby states that it generates, which are very similar to this one, they might have a very low probability in the distribution that we're trying to measure. So what this means is that we're not really in this, during this initial time, we're not really choosing states from the distribution that we actually want to be considering. However, you can show that eventually you will approach the correct distribution. There's a discussion of this in that book, section 2.2.3. I've written it in the notes. They talk about how you can show that eventually, if you wait long enough, you'll approach the right probability distribution. But what this means is that if you plot some quantity in your simulation that you're trying to measure, so if I plot the energy of all my samples, for example, so again, I can plot different things, but one thing I might plot is my energy. And then this would be as a function of how long I run the simulation. I might find that initially my states are kind of fluctuating around here. I always expect to have statistical fluctuations, but I kind of expect them to be around a consistent mean. So I might find that if I run my simulation, I initially have fluctuations that are more up here, and then eventually I converge to some more consistent mean down here. So the point is basically that if I'm trying to calculate an estimator for an expectation value, I don't want to include this part in my estimation. So we just call this an equilibration time. And then instead, we just are going to throw out those measurements instead of using all m of our measurements. So all I'm doing there is just using all the measurements I have and throwing these out. And sometimes it can be difficult to know if you've reached equilibrium. And sometimes we want to look at a few different observable quantities to figure it out. But this is the main idea. Okay, so the next thing I want to talk about is the issue where if we use a single spin flip algorithm and we use a state mu m and then mu m plus 1, which only differs from that previous state by a single spin flip, or maybe it's even the same state, we're going to find that our sampled states are going to be very correlated with each other. But if we were really generating independent samples from this Boltzmann distribution, we wouldn't have these correlations between our samples. So ideally, we want to make sure that we run an algorithm long enough so that the samples that we generate, so mu m and mu m plus 1, are independent from each other. So again, just to reiterate, when we use these single spin flip algorithms, our neighboring states are going to be very correlated, very similar to each other. So what we do in the code that we're going to use today is that we don't actually take a measurement and record something about our sample every time. We first do on the order of n updates. So we do, maybe n. Sometimes we have to do more than n. Sometimes we have to, especially near criticality, we have to do a lot more than this. But in our code, every n updates, we're going to take a measurement. So then this just means that our samples will actually be separated by many single spin flips. I should also just note that the number of updates required in a sweep depends pretty significantly on temperature. And so one thing we can do is we can actually measure how long it takes to get independent samples by measuring things called autocorrelation functions. And then again, this is something you can read about. So I should note, depending what we're trying to do, sometimes having some correlations is a bigger deal, and sometimes it's not as important. A time when it's important is if we're trying to estimate error bars on our samples. Then we're really relying on the fact that our samples are independent, and we're not going to get an accurate estimation of our error unless we really have independent samples. Another time where we'll see it is actually if you take the machine learning course in April, what we're going to do is, one thing that we're going to do is we're actually going to use Monte Carlo to generate sample configurations of different states, so samples in different phases. Then we're going to try to train a machine to figure out what the different phases are. And in that case, we don't have to train on independent samples, but since we want things to be as efficient as possible, in that case as well, it's going to be better if our samples that we generate are independent. So this is just something to keep in mind. All right, so now I'm not even going to show you the code yet. I'm just going to talk about the code that we're going to use, and then we'll look at it a bit. So we're actually going to use two programs today, but the first one is the one that actually does the Monte Carlo. So it's Icing2D Monte Carlo Python program. Oh, I wanted to ask, has everybody downloaded Python for the tutorial today? Anybody not done it yet, or anybody having problems? Okay, make sure you talk to me before the tutorial if you need help with anything. Okay. Okay, so the code that we're going to be looking at, it's going to be an icing model on an L by L lattice, so two-dimensional, and it's going to have periodic boundary conditions and no external field. So just going to draw a picture of this in the case where L equals 3, but we're going to make our code general for any dimension. So what we do is we label our sites. You can use any kind of labeling that you want, but this is the one that my code uses. So we start labeling at 0. We just start going left to right, and then we go up once we reach the end of a row. Okay. And on at a given time in our configuration, so we're going to loop for many Markov steps. But at a given Markov time, we're going to have a given state stored in our system. So I'm just drawing an example. So this just might be a state that we could be storing in our system. Again, this is just an example where L equals 3. So then N would be equal to 9. And just to remind you, okay, so what our code needs to do is it needs to somehow store the information about this state at a given time. But you remember, because we're doing these Markov updates, we don't need to store any of our earlier states because we're going to determine the next state only from the state at a given time. So I just need to store that one, and then once I'm done with it, I can just throw it away. Okay, so just for the state that I've drawn there, this is what that array we would want it to store. Just plus one if it's an upspin and negative one if it's a downspin. Okay, but when we're doing this, we're going to want to calculate observables, and we're going to need to do these Metropolis updates. And to do those updates and to take measurements of our energy, we need to be able to know what our energy is. So for that, what we need to do is this sum over nearest neighbors. So when I have a spin I need to know what all of its neighbors are. So each spin has four neighbors in this system, but I need to know what they are. So I have another array that's going to store what these neighbors are. Okay, so again, we need to calculate energies, we just need to know the nearest neighbors of every spin. So we introduce a two-dimensional array that's called neighbors. So, for example, in the case I've drawn there, maybe I want to talk about the neighbors of this site here. In this case, the way the code is written is that the first element stores its neighbor to the right, so that's going to be 4. The next neighbor is upwards, so that's going to be 6. Then this is the tricky one. The next one is going to be the neighbor to the left, but we have periodic boundary conditions. So here we have to wind back around. This one's going to store 5, and then downwards it's going to be 0. And so these are two things that we want to keep in mind, and I'm going to get you guys to just look into a little bit in today's tutorial. Okay, So just to summarize the goal of this code, what it does is it implements one of these single spin flip metropolis algorithms that we talked about yesterday. It samples these states mu, and then after doing sweeps of states, it takes a sample and it measures energy and magnetization. We do this many times for many different temperatures. Okay, so now I just kind of want to show you what this gives. So it's not just words on the board, since we are going to be coding. But does anyone have questions before we kind of look at a few things? Yeah.
So how come you store the neighbors in an array instead of like calculating it?
You could calculate them every time if you wanted, but you're going to calculate the energy many times. So I think it's just convenient to have it just stored somewhere. It doesn't really take much space to store it. Yeah, if you want, I guess you don't have to. It might not make a huge difference in time. But
yeah.
I think it can also make your code a bit more general, because you can, if you were wanting to measure things on a different lattice, for example, like a triangular lattice or a more complicated lattice, all you would need to do is change that array, and you could use like the same functions that calculate your energy, things like that. So that's kind of what stores the information about your lattice, what dimension it is, how it's connected. Anything else? Okay. So. Maybe I can ask you guys while this is warming up, how many of you have written code before? It doesn't have to be in Python, just written code at all. OK, so most of you, but not everyone. OK, how many people have used Python before? Oh, it's like almost seems like the same people. OK. So you guys are going to play with this code this afternoon. So I think it's more useful if you guys look at it rather than me just talking about it today. But this is what I'm going to be giving you. This is actually the answer. So this part has some things filled in. So it's about 150 lines. But the things you're going to be playing with adjusting are up here. We have a list of temperatures. So this just means start at 5, go down to 0.5, and have a total of 10 temperatures in between there. So you can adjust playing with different temperatures. You might want to focus more on low temperatures, high temperatures, or temperatures near the critical point. Then you can also play with the size of your lattice. So this is a 2x2 lattice. In this case, it's length 4. The one I drew was length 3. Then you're not going to change this line. This is just the number of spins. So in two dimensions, that's just L squared. You can change the coupling of your system if you want. So this J parameter in your Hamiltonian. But that's just equivalent to scaling the temperature, actually. So the critical temperature, this is actually in units of J. We just know what that is. You're not going to change that either. Some other things you can change are just these two parameters here. So the first one is how long you're going to equilibrate your samples. So again, remember that initially, when we start drawing samples, they might not be from the right distribution. So we usually want to equilibrate before we take measurements. And then the next one here is just how many measurements we want to take in total. So this takes 20 measurements. And then what this code does is that between every measurement, it does n updates. OK, so again, you guys are going to look through that a little bit more. But I wanted to just show you what it gives. So with this code, when you have animate set to true, it's actually going to show you pictures of the samples that you're generating when you run it. When you want to generate many samples, you're going to want to turn that off because it's a bit slow. But I'm just going to show you what the samples look like for now for this L equals 4 system. So we start at a high temperature, and then we're going to gradually step down to lower temperatures. OK, so this is just showing for L equals 4. We're at a pretty high temperature here. So the states basically just look random. I could have equivalently probably just generated these from a random distribution. But we're going to see, and the critical temperature is about 2.269. So as I now I'm below the critical temperature, and you can see now I'm just generating states that are either all up or all down. So you can kind of look at the difference in the states that you get using this algorithm. So these are the samples that we're using. And from these samples, we calculate these different observable quantities, like our energy and our magnetization. OK, so let's just look at what happens if I put this size of my lattice way up. And let's just see. It's just kind of fun, I think. And you can maybe gain a little bit more information about what's happening if you look at these animations for larger sizes. So again, when we start, things look pretty random. But as you go lower in temperature, you can see that I start to build up some clusters of spins, basically. So maybe the black and white sections start to group together. There's still a lot of randomness and a lot of fluctuations. But you can see that things kind of get grouped in this way. And now I haven't really run these simulations for long enough. So I can even do it bigger, maybe talk about it a bit more. So yeah, at high temperature, we're pretty easily generating random samples. So this is working pretty well. But you'll notice that in this case, when I got down to very low temperatures that were definitely below the critical point, I didn't have all up or all down. Does anyone have speculation on why that might be?
Meaning with long enough, with yeah. enough sweep.
Yeah, exactly. So our system probably wasn't equilibrated before we started taking measurements. And so this is in part because we're trying to animate this, so that takes a while. We're also looking at pretty big systems. But it also is showing us there's some problems with our algorithm. So, maybe it's hard to tell unless you compare with other algorithms. But this is just actually a general feature of these single spin flip algorithms, that it takes a very long time to generate independent samples, and it takes a long time to equilibrate. So we can get stuck in these kind of ways. So. Again, one thing I want you guys to do in tutorial is just play with how things vary as a function of temperature, how the different configurations you can get for different sizes. And then I want you to kind of experiment with changing these number of equilibration sweeps and the number of measurement sweeps to just see how that affects the different configurations you give. Because again, when we're at very small sizes, which is what we're going to be focused on today, is pretty small sizes, like L equals 4, maybe L equals 8. In these cases, this algorithm will work fine if we wait a little while. But for higher sizes, and especially when we want to study things near the critical point, we're going to have to introduce other algorithms. So does anyone have questions before I go back to the board? No? OK. Couple of problems with this single spin flip algorithm. So, and another problem, which is, it's related to the first problem. These are not two independent problems necessarily. Mm-hmm. So the first problem that we already talked about is that it takes a really long time to generate independent samples. So when you were, especially for large systems, and when you were looking at those animations, you could probably see on those larger systems that I could definitely see a relationship between the states it was generating. So I could kind of see the history of these samples. They weren't independent, and it can take a really long time to get things that are independent. The second problem, which again, it's related to the first, is that the algorithm can get stuck in a local energy minimum, especially at low temperatures. So at low temperatures, if we look at our probability of accepting a move, if that move raises the energy, then it's going to accept that move with this weight. And if T gets very small, beta gets very large. And so if E is positive, then this number becomes very small. And it's very unlikely that we're going to accept one of those moves. So to show you an example where it might get stuck. Imagine we're looking at one of these pictures that I was showing you. And it's in a state like this, where when I write orange, I'm meaning that all these states are plus one. Minus one. So at low temperatures, we expect our system to be in a ground state, which is going to be either all up or all down. This is obviously not a ground state, but there's no local move, no single spin flip that you could come up with that would ever lower the energy to get us to that ground state. So to get from this state to the ground state, we would have to first lower the energy, and that's very unlikely in this algorithm. So again, if we're at a low temperature, we're almost never going to accept a move that raises our energy in the limit of very low temperature. And that means that this algorithm can get stuck in situations like that. So to address these issues, and it doesn't completely solve them, we still, in other algorithms as well, we're still going to have this, especially this first problem, where especially near the critical point, it can take a long time to generate independent samples. But we can find algorithms that are at least a lot better than this single spin flip algorithm. And some of these algorithms for the icing model, we can use a couple of different cluster algorithms. So you can read papers that talk about these algorithms in detail. And actually, I think both of the main ones that people often use are also discussed in this Newman and Barkema book, but I'll just tell you the idea. So in this process, what we do is we flip many spins at the same time. But when we and we can actually, in some of the algorithms, we can do this in a way that we are always able to accept the move, but we don't know ahead of time what cluster of spins we're going to build. So where detailed balance comes in this case, is when we're building this cluster. So what we do is we take a spin and we look at its neighbors. And if those neighbors are in the same state, so if we start with a down spin, we're always going to build a cluster of down spins. So if we start with a spin that's down, we would look at all of its neighbors that are also down, and we would consider adding them to our cluster with some probability. And then once we've built all these clusters, we propose flipping that entire cluster of spins. So there's a couple of different algorithms that use clusters. The first algorithm was proposed by Swenson and Wang. This one builds many clusters at the same time and then flips them. And then there's another type of algorithm called Wolf cluster updates that was proposed by Wolf later. And so if we think about these cluster algorithms, if we think about the Wolf cluster update, for example, if we were in this situation, if I started with one of these up spins in this region at low temperatures, what it would probably do is build a cluster that was all of this region and then flip the whole thing. So this would immediately solve this problem of getting stuck in these local energy minima, because it could update this whole block of spins at the same time. Any questions? So you guys are not going to code the cluster algorithm today. We're just going to use the single spin algorithm, and we're just going to focus on small lattice sizes where this algorithm will be good enough for the hour and a half of time that you have during the tutorial. Okay, so we've introduced all of these methods, and now we have some techniques for calculating estimators for observable quantities, and we've kind of looked at how these configurations change as we move from high to low temperatures. But so far, I haven't really shown you any way to actually estimate where your phase transition happens on these finite systems. So that's what we're going to talk about now. Okay, so to start, I'm just going to write down a couple of things that you would have seen in some of David's lectures earlier, which is that we have critical exponents that characterize how certain quantities behave in the vicinity of a phase transition. So first, the specific heat, per spin that behaves with some critical exponent alpha. The susceptibility has a critical exponent gamma. And we can also look at something called the correlation length. It has a critical exponent nu. So yeah, this is the specific heat. So there's other quantities we can look at as well, but these are just a few that, especially the first two, we're going to be looking at in tutorial. So these variables alpha, gamma, and nu, these are just called critical exponents. And then this lowercase t, this is just a quantity to parameterize how close we are to the phase transition. Okay, and so if we think about a 2D icing model, we know how these quantities behave, and we know that the specific heat and the susceptibility diverge at the critical point. But there's no reason for these quantities to diverge if we're on a finite system, because we're not dividing by zero when we're calculating. I'll show you the expressions, and that we're not dividing by zero at any point when we're measuring these. And so on a finite system, there's no way that we're going to have this divergence. So what this looks like, if I plot either of these quantities as a function of t, I know where my phase transition is. So in the thermodynamic limit, I would expect to get something like this. But on a finite system, I'm going to get something that looks more like this, and it's not going to peak exactly at the critical point. It's going to peak near there. And the way that we actually calculate these quantities You can show. That the way we can, the way that we're going to get specific heat in our simulations is to look at estimators of E squared and subtract squared estimators of E. And then for the susceptibility, exercise would be to show how to go from here to here. Just if you're wanting to convince yourself that this is true. So what we're going to do in today's tutorial is we're going to use this code that I was showing you before to generate these independent samples, and from those samples, we're going to calculate the energy and magnetization of each sample. Then at every temperature, we're going to use all those samples to calculate the expectation values of our energy squared, our magnetization, and our magnetization squared. And from that, we're going to be able to produce plots like this one that are going to be some curve with a peak in it. We know where the critical temperature is in this case for the 2D icing model. And we're going to look at where these curves peak in comparison with TC. And the last part of the tutorial, if you get to it, is going to be to just show that as you increase the size of your system, that these curves should change in a certain way, and the peaks should get closer and closer to the critical temperature. Okay. Any questions? Okay, so we've seen that by doing something like what I've just talked about here, where we just plot some specific heats and susceptibilities, we can get an idea of where a phase transition is happening. But I'm going to show you now some theory that's going to allow us to extract the critical temperature and also to extract some of the critical exponents. Specifically, when we do these numerical calculations, we're not doing them in the thermodynamic limit. We have to do them on finite lattices. So we want to see how we can best extract information about our critical point and its critical exponents from these finite lattice calculations. So now, this first thing I'm just going to have you note is just something we can just observe from the equations I've already given you. So near the critical point, since our susceptibility behaves in this way, and our correlation length behaves in this way, I can just write that I can write my susceptibility in a form that looks like the critical point. So I should mention too that right now I'm going to be focusing on a method that would allow us to determine this critical exponent here, this gamma one. But of course, this method is more general and it can be used to extract other critical exponents. This example is just for the susceptibility. So we see that in the vicinity of our phase transition, we know that we expect this susceptibility to diverge, for example, for an icing model. We can write that divergence in terms of its correlation length. This correlation length also diverges at the critical point. But this is on a finite system, if we're trying to, again, we saw that we're not actually going to have divergences on a finite system. But we can kind of think about a reason for this if we think about the correlation length. So the correlation length kind of measures the distance on our lattice over which spins are going to be correlated. But if we're on a finite system, I'm never going to be able to observe a correlation that's bigger than my system size, right? I'm limited by this size L or something on the order of L. So to write that in words, so on a finite system, my correlations are limited by the linear size, some order, some linear order of that. So what I would actually expect to see if I were to plot this quantity is that it's still going to behave in this way as long as I'm in a regime where my correlation length is a lot smaller than my system size. But otherwise, I'm going to expect that the largest correlation I'm going to see is L. And so this quantity is actually going to scale in this way instead. Or I can just write this instead. As this initial expression I have times some constant, times some function. So in the simulations, sometimes it can be difficult to measure our correlation length, or maybe we just aren't really interested in measuring it directly. So let's just eliminate the correlation length from this expression. So part of this is also just the convention that this process is usually done. So I'm just going to show you how to get to the expression that you'll more often see. So just using the known relationships that we have between this correlation length and the reduced temperature and its critical exponent, we can just rewrite this. Okay, so this last line is what I want to get to in the end. Again, this is just doing a few lines to manipulate this expression that I've written down. Okay, so I get this expression in the end that if I plot my susceptibility per spin and I multiply by this factor here, I should get some function that only depends on L to the power of 1 over the correlation length exponent times my reduced temperature. And what this means is that I know at least how these curves are supposed to behave, and they're only going to depend on this one parameter in the vicinity of this critical point, as long as I have the right critical exponents. Okay, so what this means is that if we have the right gamma and nu critical exponents and the right critical temperature, we're going to get a collapse when we plot these curves, so that for some region that's near the critical temperature, all of these curves are going to collapse onto the same curve. And so what we can do is we can adjust these parameters until that collapse happens, and that's going to show us what these critical exponents are supposed to be. So let me put that one up. So maybe I'll just show you what I mean by this. So if I were to plot this first quantity, I'm going to plot this for different sizes. If I plot this and I have all the right exponents chosen, maybe these are my data points for L equals 4 or something. Or maybe I need to go a bit higher to get this. I'll just say, like, I don't know, 16 or something. For whatever sizes you have, you should find that all this data, when you have these selected properly, should all collapse onto a single curve. And that's the technique that people use to, one of the techniques that can be used to try to figure out these critical exponents. As I said, this one was the one that I showed you here. This is just specifically putting in susceptibility and gamma. But if I want to extract a different critical exponent, like the specific heat, all I have to do is specific heat here and change this to be an exponent alpha. The same procedure. It's probably a different quantity. Any questions about that? OK, so we have a few minutes. So I'm going to talk to you guys now about how we might do simulations of other types of models. So we've talked only about the icing model so far in my lectures. But I know you guys have also seen other models from David. And one model in particular is called the XY model. It looks pretty similar to the icing model when you write it in this form. But in this case, instead of our variables just being up and down, they're allowed to rotate on a circle. So this is our model. We're just talking about a bunch of angles, basically. So I'm just going to have some arrows that live on a circle that are just going to be described by some angle. Okay, so one thing that you might have seen that's cool about this model is that in two dimensions, there's no phase transition in the sense that there's no specific kind of phase transition where we transition to a state with long-ranged order. This is the Merman-Wagner theorem. You guys have talked about this, right? Yeah, okay. Okay, so again, this is a special kind of phase transition. It's called a Kosterlitz-Thallus transition. This was one of the topics of study of last year's Nobel Prize. So all of that, I mean, what I've written here, this is just a motivation of why we might want to study this model. It's maybe going to tell us something different than just looking at an icing model. Maybe we have to develop different techniques. But before we can do that, before we can even study it using the numerical methods I've shown you, we have to figure out an algorithm that we could use for this. So we can still do a single spin update. Does anyone have a suggestion for what a single spin update might look like in this type of model?
A random rotation?
Yeah, exactly, right? It's not just going to be a random flip in this case. We kind of have two elements of randomness now. Instead of just choosing a site at random, we have to choose a site, we have to choose a spin we want to rotate, and then we also have to choose an angle that we want to rotate it by. So we started out in some state, and we're going to choose a site I at random, and we're going to propose rotating it by some angle. Okay, so things would actually look the same as before. We could use the same acceptance probabilities as before that are just based on the energy changes. It's just that the actual move we have to propose has to be a little bit more general. So in this case, we have to choose the site I and also choose this delta theta at random. Okay, so we could implement this move. We can also do more advanced cluster moves for this type of theory. And once we've done that, we're going to have a Monte Carlo simulation that generates data of various observables. And then one thing we might want to do is try to use these measurements to gain information about our transition. So one thing we can do is try to estimate the critical temperature, the Kosterlitz-Thallus temperature. But we can't use the same techniques as before because this is a special kind of transition. So one thing that's known for this transition is that we have a relationship between our Clausewitz-Thales transition and something called the spin stiffness. So this is a quantity. I know I'm just kind of throwing this expression at you. But the point is just that this is something we can measure in Monte Carlo. And so from this expression, and by doing some proper finite size scaling analysis, which I won't go through, but you can read papers about how to do this really carefully on finite size lattices, we can basically use this expression to estimate what our critical temperature actually is. If I'm on systems that are big enough, then if I were to plot this spin stiffness as a function of temperature, it should intersect with the line that's just 2t over pi at that critical point, because those quantities are equal at that point. So what this actually would look like if I just plot this line, 2t over pi, and if I do my simulations, what you can see is that on low systems, I'm going to get something like this. These are just made up numbers, but if I plot the stiffness and I increase my size, I'm going to see that this stiffness is going to get sharper, and these lines are going to start to intersect closer and closer to where my phase transition is. So what people do is you have to do some finite size scaling theory to figure out the proper way to do it, but they study the location of these crossing points as a function of size. So what we do is in a way that uses some of these finite size scaling arguments, we look at where these lines cross, what value of t they cross at, and we look at how this crossing point behaves as a function of size. And we try to somehow figure out how to extrapolate to the thermodynamic limit. Any questions at all? That's all I wanted to cover for today. So any questions before I let you guys go? Okay, so this afternoon in tutorial, just to reiterate, we're going to look at some Python code that does a Monte Carlo simulation of the two-dimensional icing model. It's just going to use the single spin flip algorithm. We're going to focus on pretty small sizes where this algorithm works pretty well. And what we're going to do is we're going to plot things like the susceptibility and the specific heat and get a rough estimate of where our phase transition is from those plots. Yeah.
What if we didn't know about this relation? About spin stiffness and...
If we didn't know about this relationship?
How would we find the critical temperature?
I don't know what other techniques are for finding this. There's other models too that are not exactly the XY model, but have the same type of transition into a quasi long range order phase, and you still use this kind of technique. I don't know. I don't know if there's another way to do it actually. Okay, see you guys this afternoon.
Yeah.